Ways and Means.
You didn't like them.
I will open the Joint Ways and Means Committee for February 25th, 2016. We're starting it off with the three agency reports. And then we obviously have quite a number of policy bills, and we have the core budget bills for this session. So I'm going to start off with the Department of Administrative Services, compensation plan changes. Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On February 24th, the General Budget Subcommittee voted to recommend acknowledging receipt of a report from the Department of Administrative Services on the compensation plan changes. The report covers the bargaining agreements with the State Teachers Education Association, selective salary adjustments to the administrative law judge classification, and implementation of a new investment analyst position classification within Oregon State Treasury. DAS estimates the total cost of the agreements in the report will be $222,354 general fund and $237,774 total funds for the 2015-17 biennium. With roll-up costs, the 2017-19 impact is $400,538 general fund and $442,478 total fund. Mr. Co-Chair, in committee yesterday, I asked Mr. Naughton about the average compensation and the mean compensation for Oregon State public employees. He didn't have those figures yesterday. I managed to get down here without them a few minutes ago, but they're in the ballpark of $88,000 a year for state employees for the average and $85,000 a year for the mean employee compensation, and that is on a rolling basis. The General Government Subcommittee recommends approval of the report.
The motion is on the floor. Discussion. Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries. Open a work session on Department of Consumer and Business Services, Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, colleagues, and apologies for the page and a half pony. On February 23rd, the Transportation and Economic Development Subcommittee voted to recommend acknowledging receipt of a report from the Department of Consumer and Business Services on health insurance marketplace publicity and publication plan, as required by budget note, with instructions that DBCS submit a follow-up report to the Emergency Board on the full review of the 2016 open enrollment plan year campaign and the agency's plan for the 2017 open enrollment plan year campaign, including baseline metrics for the campaign goals during September 2016 legislative days. In accordance with the budget note included in the agency's budget, DCBS submitted a publicity and publication plan and report to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means in January prior to the 2016 session, noting that 137,820 Oregonians have enrolled in health insurance through the marketplace as of January 16th, 2016, 25,000 more people than the prior year. DCBS segmented the plan into two outreach and education campaigns, one for the 2016 plan year and one for the 2017 plan year. Although the 2016 campaign plan is well detailed in the report, there is no detail provided for the 2017 campaign. DCBS states that it believes the 2017 campaign will be similar in scope and tactics to the 2016 campaign, but that DCBS will begin planning the 2017 campaign only after it has had time to analyze the results of the 2016 campaign. The report presents the methodology for developing the campaign, the information gained from its research activities, and the tactical activities through which the agency would be implementing its campaign. The 2016 campaign focuses on targeted activities and markets, eschewing mass media campaign activities that are pursued by the federal marketing program in order to avoid duplication of efforts and to address specific populations that have had a high percentage of uninsured individuals. Since this is the first year that DCBS has conducted its marketing and outreach campaign for the marketplace, it has not set specific targets or metrics for the detailed activities. DCBS intends to complete a full review of the campaign following the end of the open enrollment period. DCBS also included potential key performance indicators and potential metrics for each of the goals. The Transportation and Economic Development Subcommittee recommends acknowledging receipt of the report with instructions.
Motion is before the committee. Discussion of the motion. Any objections to the motion before the committee? Seeing none, motion carries. Next item, Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On February 23rd, the Natural Resource Subcommittee voted to recommend acknowledging receipt of a report by the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries on a comprehensive IT assessment completed by the Department and the Office of the State Chief Information Officer. The report identified a variety of issues, concerns, and gaps that require near, medium, and long-term resolution. The report includes recommendations from the OCO, including having the department outsource IT functions not related to core mapping or data needs, directing the department to develop plans for server and storage infrastructure requirements for mapping and data needs and housing that infrastructure off-site. Currently, the department and OCO are in the process of jointly developing a tactical IT remediation plan to address and mitigate the highest priority issues found during the assessment. The Natural Resources Subcommittee recommends acknowledging receipt of the report with the understanding that the department will do the following. One, regularly provide progress status reports to OCO, DAS, CFO, and LFO. Partner with OCO to jointly develop and present a tactical IT recommendation plan to the Emergency Board and the GLCIMT during the May 2016 legislative days, including any requests for additional resources necessary to carry out the plan. And finally, develop and present a plan and supporting budget requests as part of the 2017-19 budget development process for implementing the report's recommendations. The Natural Resource Subcommittee recommends approval.
Motion is before the committee. Discussion of the motion before the committee. Any objection to the motion before the committee? Seeing none, motion carries. We'll go on to House Bill 4002 relating to chronic abscesses. Representative Kamp.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On February 24th, the General Government Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of House Bill 4002 with amendments. The Oregon Department of Education is directed to develop and implement a statewide plan to address chronic absences of students in public schools. The plan will be developed in collaboration with the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Health Authority, the Early Learning Division, community and education stakeholders. ODE is directed to submit a report no later than December 1, 2016, to the interim legislative committees regarding the statewide education plan. Consulting costs to research, plan, facilitate, and summarize five stakeholder meetings are estimated about the cost $25,500 general fund in the 2015-17 biennium. As amended, the bill will also direct the Chief Education Office to coordinate with OHA and ODE to design and implement a pilot program to decrease rates of school absenteeism using trauma-informed approaches to education, health services, and intervention strategy. The CEDO, OHA, ODE, and I do hate acronyms, folks, and the selected nonprofit organizations are directed to submit a report to the interim committees of the Legislative Assembly no later than October 15, 2019. The CEDO is appropriated $500,000 general fund for the 2015-17 biennium for administrative costs and award grant awards. The General Government Subcommittee recommends House Bill 4002 be amended by the -6 amendment and be reported out do pass as amended.
Motion is before the committee. Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really appreciate the work on this bill. I hope we can get some results back on it. I'm disappointed that the funding is as low as it is because in the report that we got from the LFO analyst, with the amount that's being put at one of our top critical problems identified in education, which is absenteeism, chronic absenteeism, kind of right up there with the dropout rate and everything else. We may only get a quarter of an FTE in that position to try to get us the results we want. I think we need to say a blessing over this bill to help it along. because I'm not sure the funding we're putting at it is going to be adequate.
Additional discussion? Yes, Senator Whitson.
Just very briefly, this bill is a step in the right direction, but it really doesn't address the issue. Our absenteeism is inversely proportional to our graduation rate. It's almost linear. And the way to fix this, I believe, is to change our school formula to an average daily attendance, in which case the attendance suddenly becomes very, very important to the school districts. And until that happens, I don't see it getting fixed. Thank you.
Any additional discussion? Yes, Senator Durant.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Colleagues, and I've said this before, we desperately need an audit coming out of the Department of Ed. It's a $1 billion expenditure. We have no idea what goes in and what comes out and what the cost is in between. It would be nice to know that. There might be more money in there than we think. It's just we need an audit.
Additional. Representative Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just a final comment. The irony of me carrying this pony is not lost on me or a number of the committee members that I sit with, but the first bill I ever wrote as a legislator was about chronic absenteeism, and that was in 2005, and that problem had been around at least 20, 30 years before that, and so it is my wish as my parting bill that I'll be carrying on the floor that this moves forward, that we do find some solutions for the future for education.
Anything additional? Seeing none, Senator Bates.
Mr. Co-Chair, I'd like to question the carriages for a second. You've been in education for a long time.
Yes, sir.
I've been a doctor for a long time. I've seen the families that fell for a long time. I used to be on the school board. I don't believe we can legislate this as a step in the right direction, but kids don't come to school because they're homeless, because they're sick, because there's drugs and alcohol and mental issues in the family. That's the reason kids don't come to school. And until we deal with those really hard problems, we're going to have a problem in the state with absenteeism and dropouts. And I just wanted to make that point that this is not simply putting someone in place to hammer the schools further to get the kids to school. They should do that. They should do that. But we should talk about the real problems behind that.
Yes, Representative Pompey, do you want to respond?
Yes. Senator, co-chairs Buckley and Devlin and Senator Bates, I am a little emotional today, but I do want to share with this committee and, yes, all the audiences out there that there are many reasons why people are absent. I was absent from the floor today because I wasn't feeling well. But I do want to say to all of you, we are very fortunate to have Dr. Bates and Dr. Steiner Hayward here in our body. 6 years ago, Dr. Bates basically saved my life, and it was because of health reasons. And yes, and so some of us do have a legitimate excuse to be absent, and I'll miss all of you dearly.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Thank you. Subcommittee worked on this for a long time. I've been an educator for 50 years. Some school districts are simply better at dealing with chronic absenteeism than others. Even given the reasons that Dr. Bates outlined, there are some school districts, for example, David Douglas, that are doing a better job of dealing with chronic absenteeism than others. I hope that this pilot project, even though it's only funded at a $500,000 instead of the $2 million I wanted, I hope that it will give us some information about which districts are being successful and why.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
I just can't let the opportunity pass. I support the bill. I'm not going to be talking about chronic absenteeism. I'm going to be reflecting on the fact that former principal, former teacher, former superintendent Comp said she's been working on this for 30 years, and yet this has an emergency clause on it. This is yet one more example of the abusive use of emergency clauses that the legislature has fallen victim to.
Okay. Any additional discussion? Senator Whitson.
Punctuation on Senator Monroe's comments. I traveled down to southern Texas with a group of the Oregon top educators, and While the family issues are very important,
he overcame them.
That area down there has English second language, about 70% of the kids. The poverty level is over 90%. Drug use is rampant. I mean, it's not a place where you want to get out of your car. And yet that school district went from about 62% graduation rate to around 90% in less than 5 years. And they did it by causing the kids to go to school.
Representative Smith.
I gotta weigh in on this.
Maybe we'll just wear you all out by the time we get to the 10th item.
By the time we get to the end, we'll have nothing to say. I think there's some structural issues as well. I'm going to go back 30 years ago because the statute of limitations is now passed for me. And
what were you doing when you're skipping school?
I was off at McDonald's or Taco Bell or dinking around with my girlfriend or off playing with my buddies or what have you. And think about this: if you're a junior in high school and you know your path and you've already been accepted to a university, there's very little motivation to keep you engaged in high school, and that's especially true for seniors. At Heppner High School, I've had multiple kids go through there. They're all in a respected university, but their senior year, there's not a lot for these kids to do. And so absenteeism, I mean, there's multiple reasons besides just economic or health reasons as to why kids aren't showing up at school.
Any additional comments?
And I use the term dinking around with my girlfriend. Just meaning out playing around.
You don't want any broader explanation.
Yeah.
Okay. Any objection to the motion before the committee?
My mom's going to be mad.
Seeing no objection, motion carries.
Hey.
I'm not telling her.
HB 4017 relating to health care center Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. First of all, I apologize for opening up my conversation on the last bill. House Bill 4017 related to health care. Let us all be aware of wide relating clauses. This bill drove me crazy in subcommittee. On February 24th, the Human Services Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of House Bill 4017 with amendments. The measure directs the Department of Consumer and Business Services in collaboration with the Oregon Health Authority and in consultation with a stakeholder advisor group to develop a blueprint for a basic health plan and include that blueprint in a report to the interim committees of the Legislative Assembly no later than December 31st of 2016. The bill also designates DCBS as the sole state agency authorized to request a state innovation waiver from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services under the Affordable Care Act for the implementation of a BHP as described in the blueprint created by DCBS. I love this stuff. The bill requires DCBS to present its recommendations for the submission of the waiver application to the legislature by March 1, 2017. If found to be financially viable by the federal program under the waiver conditions and enabling legislation to create and implement the BHP is adopted by the state, the basic health plan could be established as a state-funded or state-subsidized health insurance option available in the Oregon health insurance marketplace. The measure also includes an increase in other funds limitation of $415,000 to DCBS to pay for the planning and actuarial work related to the creation of the BHE blueprint and the supporting documentation for an application for a state innovation waiver. The measure also includes language amending Chapter 575 Oregon Law 2015 to require annual reporting on the proportion of medical expenses allocated to primary care services by carriers, coordinated care organizations, the Public Employees Benefit Board, and the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, and how those entities pay for primary care, extending the existing repeal of that reporting section to January of 2020. The bill amends statute defined routine health care and exempt from the definition certain activities related to approved clinical trials. The bill prohibits discrimination by coordinated care organization against members on the basis of the member participating in an approved clinical trial and limits the liability of coordinated care organization for any adverse effects of approved clinical trials. Human Services Subcommittee recommends House Bill 4017 be amended by the A16 amended and reported out due path as amended. This bill has a lot of different things in it. The committee worked on them very hard. It was sort of the Christmas tree for a lot of issues down our committee. It has this wide relating clause, but we went through it. I'm asking for support for it, and I'll be glad to answer any questions that I can possibly answer on these.
Senator Johnson.
A report to the legislature, once again worthy of an emergency clause. Abusive.
Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion before the committee? Please note Senator Hansel, Senator Thompson, Senator Girard, Senator Whitsitt, Representative Smith, Representative Wisnett, Representative Huffman, Representative McLean, Representative Wisnett. Whitsitt and Wisnett.
Yes, sir. You make a comment.
He can't get them all that fast. Do I do a roll call? It'd be easier.
Okay, we'll do a roll call.
Make a comment.
Otherwise, I have to test my memory each time. So, did you have a comment?
Yes,
or did
sir.
I go too quick?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I plan to be a no. I hope I didn't promise someone a yes on this. I'll listen to their comment again if we go to the floor. But I will be a no today. Apologize.
Mr. Rocker, will you call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Kump.
Aye.
Representative Wisnett.
No.
Representative Huffman.
No.
Representative McLean.
No.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Williamson.
Aye.
Representative Gombert.
Aye.
Representative Rayfield.
Yes.
Representative Whitsitt.
No.
Co-Vice Chair Smith.
No.
Co-Vice Chair Nathanson.
Aye.
Co-Chair Buckley.
Aye.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Girard?
No.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steiner-Hewitt?
Aye.
Senator Hansel?
No.
Senator Roblin?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Devlin?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Close that work session. Open a work session, HB 4020, relating to Oregon Growth Board. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. House Bill 4020 will sound familiar to House members because we passed it across the House floor 59-0. It relates to the Oregon Growth Board, which manages a small portion of funds from the Education Stability Fund. It does so for two purposes, to generate returns to the Education Stability Fund and to help fill capital gaps for growing Oregon businesses. And it does that by investing in Oregon-focused venture funds. The bill changes a small shall to may and removes a barrier to the Growth Board's success in generating those returns and filling those capital gaps. Does that with no cost, and in anticipation of Senator Johnson's comments, there is an emergency clause on this one for a specific reason, because there are some funds that the Growth Board would like to look at and would like to be able to use this legislation if possible. So the Capital Construction Subcommittee recommends House Bill 4020A be reported out, do pass.
Discussion of the motion before the committee. Yes. Representative McLean.
Mr. Chair, am I correct that 4020 has already passed the House unanimously?
It has.
Correct.
Okay. And then second of all, why is it in Ways and Means then?
It was referred to Ways and Means in the Senate.
Well, that certainly makes sense.
Oh my God.
Just one additional question. Since we passed in the House, did the Ways and Means Committee add an emergency clause?
No.
We took it off.
No.
They added it.
Mr. Chair, the emergency clause was added in the House Policy Committee. It was there when we passed it on the House floor.
Oh, thank goodness.
How did it get to Ways and Means?
Then thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to renew my support, and I'm just excited that we took time in the Ways and Means Committee for this. Thank you very much. This is excellent.
You did say 59-0, didn't you?
I did.
Yes.
So
yes.
There's not a one no, so I don't have to worry about any of the votes on this side.
First part of that, I will say, Representative Widener was absent. He was not a no vote. But I can't speak for the rest of our House members today.
Okay.
He's an independent thinker.
Okay. Any additional comments? Any additional questions?
Wow.
Any objections to the motion before the committee? Seeing none, motion carries. Open work session, HB 4042, relating to General Assistance, Senator Steiner-Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On February 24th, the Human Services Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of House Bill 4042 with amendments. The bill creates a general assistance project capped at 200 participants per month who are homeless, enrolled in a medical assistance program, and have a disability that would likely qualify for federal SSI or SSDI benefits. Participants will receive a payment of $695 per month to be used for housing assistance, utilities, personal incidentals, and get help applying for federal benefits. Some of the state funding will be recovered when a participant starts receiving SSI or SSDI payments. It is estimated that about 80% of participants will be eligible. An advisory group will help develop project metrics. This amendment adds the amendment adds compiling a list of attorneys to help participants to the advisory group's charge and sets a July 2nd, 2016 operating date. It also appropriates $1.6 million general fund and adds $65,348 other funds expenditure limitation to the DHS budget for program startup, administration, and benefit payments. The agency's fiscal impact statement includes costs for three positions to set up and coordinate payments, to assist in obtaining housing, and to perform tracking required to receive federal reimbursement. The Human Services Subcommittee recommends House Bill 4042 be amended by the Dash 3 amendment and be reported out due pass as amended.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Is there discussion on the motion?
Yes. Representative Woodson.
Thank you, Chair. So, in one place it says that they have a disability that would qualify them, and then you said likely have. And so, is there a distinction there?
Representative, are you talking about in the pony or in the bill itself?
Yeah, in the pony.
The first part of the pony says have a disability that would likely qualify, and the estimate is that about 80% of participants will be eligible for SSI or SSDI payments, so it's impossible to predict exactly which disabilities will end up qualifying someone for SSI or SSDI payments, or it makes them, you know, actually eligible and approved. So we would not want to guarantee something that we can't guarantee.
Okay. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I probably should know the answer to this. I do not. When some of these SSI applications are over multiple years, they're denied, they are appealed, they drag on for an awfully long time. How long do the benefit qualifications last?
I would have to, maybe Co-Chair Bates can from that committee can advise on that answer.
On a practical basis, I see this every day in the practice, so I can give you roughly what happens. Most cases are settled in 12 to 18 months. A few of them drag on because, you know, it'll go on for 2 or 3 years. Those are pretty rare. Most time in 12 to 18 months are settled. By the time that the case starts, that's the starting time for considering disability, and go on for 12 to 18 months. And if they're successful, and about 80% are successful, the money from that time to here is given out as one lump sum. We claw that money back because we've given them general assistance during that time. These people, it's a very limited program, it's for about 200 people. People in this position often end up in our streets, living under our bridges because they're homeless, because they have no money coming in. Others have family that can help them sometimes. So it's a revolving fund except for about that 20%. And we've had it 10 years ago, but during the recession we cut it all out. And so it's a real problem for these people. And it's something that we've done before. It's been successful. But again, 20% probably never get disability, and we'll have to pick that difference up as we go along with this program, but most move all through. The first year, we'll have to put more in because the money won't come in until that settlement is made. And there are those rare cases that go on for years and years and years. It'd still be the same if they were in that group of 200.
Mr. Chair, I could understand how this might actually qualify as an emergency, and it does not have an emergency clause.
Okay. Any additional discussion? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Question. I see that the program is capped at at 200 participants per month. Was there any discussion on how we're going to geographically disperse these dollars?
If you have.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Smith. Oh,
That's fine.
Oh, you're the one.
I will just make a brief statement and ask staff to follow up. I asked that exact question. What will be the geographic distribution, even though clients aren't selected yet? I asked, what is the distribution of persons able to do this rather expert professional kind of assistance, because I didn't want it to be assumed that, oh, this is just about the big city, that we have areas statewide that need help. So there is a map that is now available. I think on OLIS, it's the ALBE testimony, A-L-L-B-E-E. If you look at that, there will be a list of places and a map showing where people will be available to start handling these cases.
Thank you, Madam Co-Vice Chair, and thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay. Did you feel the need to laugh?
Nothing else to add.
Any additional questions or comments? Any objection to the motion before the committee? Seeing none, motion carries. We will go on to HB 4071 relating to health care for Pacific Islanders. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. On February 24th, the Human Services Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of House Bill 4071 with amendments. House Bill 4071 establishes a financial assistance program to pay the premium costs of qualified health plans and the out-of-pocket expenses for the coverage provided under those plans for certain individuals residing in Oregon under a Compact of Free Association, or COFA, with income less than 138% of the federal poverty guidelines. The program is to be administered by the Department of Consumer and Business Services with the advice in the development, implementation, and operation of the program from an advisory committee appointed by DCPS as required by the bill. The measure includes a one-time general fund appropriation of $1,823,000 for deposit into the COFA Premium Assistance Fund established in the bill. The amendment establishes an other funds expenditure limitation for the Department of Consumer and Business Services in the amount of $1,823,000 for expenditures of monies from the fund. The Human Services Subcommittee recommends House Bill 4071 be amended by the Dash 2 amendment and be reported out, do pass as amended.
Discussion of the motion before the committee. Senator Whitsitt, then Senator Bates.
I just a question. What's the source of the other funds?
The other funds will be, may I answer?
Please go.
Other funds will come from two different, well, from one source primarily. These people are at a low enough income level that they qualify for tax rebates from the federal government to pay most of the premium on their policies, probably silver policies. But there will still be a gap in that as far as copays are concerned, so that would be coming from general funds.
And it's not just, it doesn't come from other funds. So.
I would consider the premiums being paid by federal government's other funds, but maybe you don't. Mark?
Mr. Co-Chair, Matt Stanner with the Legislative Fiscal Office, Senator Whitsitt. There's two pieces in this bill, funding piece. One of them is a general fund appropriation. The general fund appropriation gets deposited into this COFA assistance account, and for the purpose of accounting in the state, that's considered an expenditure when it goes into that account. And then for DCBS to then expend those funds that were deposited, those general funds that were deposited, DCBS expends those funds as other funds. And so therefore, it's just a double counting for accounting purposes.
It's once longer general fund, okay.
I did want to make a comment.
Yes, Senator Bates.
I want to especially thank Representative Olson for the work he did in this. He championed this and really drove it through legislation for us. He's taken a very special interest in these people who are our allies in World War II, never got full citizenship, but are allowed to come to this country under without visas, but don't have the normal privileges of citizens, and therefore, even though they're in poverty, aren't part of the Medicaid plan. So. I just wanted to let him know that he worked very hard in this, took this on, and really brought it home to us.
Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion before the committee? Seeing none, motion carries. We'll go on. Open work session HB 4076 relating to enabling students to be successful in the Oregon Promise Program. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Co-Chair Devlin. On February 24th, the Education Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of HB 4076 with amendments. HB 4076 makes several changes to the Oregon Promise Program. These changes include requiring community colleges to provide support services for students receiving Oregon Promise grants, requiring students participating in the Oregon Promise Program to complete approved first-year experience to maintain grant eligibility, aligning grade point averages with requirements for the program to federal financial aid standards. Community colleges and the Higher Ed Coordinating Committee to report on how funds appropriated in this bill are spent for support services. The bill also provides $1.7 million general fund for support services to students and for faculty and other staff development to implement proven strategies leading to better academic success and completion rates. The funding will be distributed evenly among the community college, except that Portland Community College will receive a greater share given that it has four major campuses. The Education Subcommittee recommends that HB 4076 be amended by the -4 amendment and be reported out due pass as amended.
Discussion of the motion before the committee. Yes. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just want to compliment the carrier and Representative Johnson for his hard work on this concept. The bill started in the Higher Education Committee in the House. It's also good news. The Oregonian reported today that with 6 days left, 12,000 Oregon students have applied for this program. They suggest that it's probably something around 7,000 that will meet the criteria, but one of our best investments, and I think this fits with that, so I appreciate the work. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Additional discussion or questions? Seeing none, any objection to the motion before the committee? Seeing none, motion carries. Open a work session, close that work session, open a work session, HB 4079, relating to housing. Senator Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On February 25th, the Capital Construction Subcommittee recommended passage of House Bill 4079 with amendments. House Bill 4079 requires the Land Conservation and Development Commission to establish and implement an affordable housing pilot program, adopting rules to implement that program before July 1st, 2017. The commission is to select two pilot projects, one from a city with a population of less than 25,000 and one from a city with a population greater than 25,000. The bill requires LCDC to adopt rules defining affordable housing, specifying the types of affordable housing allowed on the pilot project sites, limiting the total acreage of the pilot project to no more than 50 acres, and specifying a local government effort that demonstrate the accommodation and encouragement of the local government in the development of needed housing. LCDC is also required to adopt rules that specify requirements for affordable housing that may include the sale price and the rental rate range, and LCDC is allowed to establish a rule allowing for an expedited process for amending urban growth boundaries to include pilot project sites. The bill also provides direction of local governments where pilot projects are cited regarding duties and restrictions of local government with respect to the project LCDC is required to report on the progress of the pilot program to committees of the Legislative Assembly related to the housing and human service following the 2016 legislative session and for three consecutive legislative sessions beginning with 2017 session. The measure includes one-time general fund appropriation to the Department of Land Conservation and Development in the amount of $100,000 for carrying out the provisions of this bill. The Capital Construction Subcommittee recommends House Bill 4079 be amended with the B-12 amendment and reported out due pass as amended.
Now I'm going to go to Co-Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Members, this is a little unusual. We have to do a technical fix here as proposed by LFO. So I move that the recommendation be modified so as to replace the B-12 amendment with the B-13 amendment. The reason for the change is to correct which ORS is cited in the underlying bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 4079 be amended by the B-13 amendment and reported out due pass as amended.
Discussion of the motion before the committee. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be painfully clear, the -13 is identical, keeping out my irrigation district. There are Okay.
Mr. Ruckus confirming.
Yes.
I'm good. Thank you. Yes, Senator Hansel.
I just want to go on record thinking this is a good bill, and I'll be supportive.
Any additional discussion? Representative Reed.
Mr. Co-Chair, just a clarification. The way the motion was described, I want to be clear. Is this going to be one vote for the amendment and the report out, or are we going to be voting for the amendment
we have to
and
vote
then separately?
That's a good question.
I can clarify, but I think I'll ask Mr. Rocco, but normally when we're here, as you all know, committees don't actually amend bills. Our subcommittees don't. They recommend amendments, so usually it's all within the motion. So you'll see recommend approval with the dash such
one,
and
one
such.
Vote.
But I'll ask Mr. Rocco for clarification for the comfort of people here.
Mr. Chair, members, this is the motion is to adopt the B-13 amendment, report the bill out, to pass as amended with the B-13.
Thank you for the clarification.
Okay. Any additional discussion? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and I appreciate the efforts behind this bill, and I do understand that a great deal of the discussion has happened around the housing issues. I will be a courtesy yes to make sure the bill does get to the House floor, although I most likely will be a no on the House floor. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay. Any additional discussion? Yes.
Mr. Co-Chair, I share my the Co-Chair's sentiments. I will be a courtesy yes and reserve my right to vote no on the floor.
Any additional discussion? I will not be a courtesy yes, I will actually be a no, but I do believe I have sufficient votes on the Senate side to pass this measure, and I just want to have you let this know that this is evidence that the co-chairs don't actually always stop bills. Because I just want to put that on the record. Any objections to the motion? We'll note them all. Representative Rayfield, Representative Reed, Senator Devlin. Any other objections? Seeing none, motion carries. Okay, close out work session, open a work session, HB 4086, relating to unemployment benefits. Representative Rayfield.
On February 23rd, the Education Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of House Bill 4086. The bill provides an additional 26 weeks of unemployment insurance benefits for locked-out workers in an amount equal to the individual's most recent unemployment claim. The bill permits the retroactive payment of temporary lockout benefits to individuals in a lockout if weekly benefits are claimed by the individual within 60 days of passage of this legislation. If provisions of this bill are determined to be uncompliant with the requirements of the Social Security Act or the Federal Unemployment Tax Act, then the legislation will be considered null, and the director of the Oregon Employment Department will be required to notify legislative council that such a determination has been made. There is no other fund expenditure limitation provided in the bill, and the Employment Department is directed to carry out the provisions of the bill using existing budgetary resources. The Education Subcommittee recommends House Bill 4086 be reported out due pass.
Okay. Discussion of the motion before the committee. Senator Whitson.
I think you might we ask the LFO analyst to discuss why this bill might be determined to be uncompliant with the Social Security Act or the Federal Unemployment Tax Act?
It's Representative Rayfield, then we'll have staff.
Yeah, and Representative Whitson, that was actually language that the Unemployment Department recommended putting into the bill. The way that this works, from my primitive understanding of trying to learn this, is that when you, everything must be compliant with the federal folks, and so in this case, they can get kind of a nod that it might be approved. However, once the bill passed, then everything goes up to check to see if it's in compliance. So this is more or less a safety provision in there that in the unlikely event that something were to go wrong, we have that in and we can come back and fix it.
Do you need additional clarification from staff, Senator Whitson? Yes, please. Okay. Additional questions? Any objection to the motion before the committee? Representative McLean, Representative Whitsitt, Senator Whitsitt, Senator Thompson, and Senator Hansel. Motion carries. We'll go to the back of the agenda, HB 4093, relating to courthouses, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On February 24th, the Public Safety Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of House Bill 4093 with amendments. House Bill 4093 allows circuit courts to impose a $5 surcharge on fines imposed for parking violations or traffic offenses to help finance capital costs or debt payments for courthouse capital construction projects that are funded in the state budget. The revenue from the surcharge accrues to the county and is dedicated to the courthouse project. To date, the legislature has approved funding for courthouse replacement projects in Multnomah, Jefferson, and Tillamook counties. Authority to establish the surcharge would initially be restricted to those three counties, but it would extend to other counties if additional courthouse projects are approved by the legislature. The surcharge would help counties finance their portion of the project's total cost. And Mr. Co-Chair, this bill originally included a court filing fee surcharge to help raise funds on a county-by-county basis for the state's portion of the courthouse construction costs. The Oregon Judicial Department is convening a work group during the interim to discuss raising court filing fees to fund its e-court system. And I hope that OJD will please consider this some legislative direction to include courthouse funding in its future discussions of increasing court filing fees. That being said, the Public Safety Subcommittee recommends House Bill 4093 be amended by the -A9 amendment and be reported out due pass as amended.
Discussion of the motion before the committee. Yes, Senator Johnson.
Just a question. Will this be the last time that the legislature can expect the advocates for courthouses to come back with yet another scheme to fund them?
No.
I'll take that as a rhetorical question.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'll be opposing this bill for two reasons today. The first is that, as I read the bill, the first $5 of each traffic ticket and each moving violation goes to the court system for this purpose. And another reason is the two are together. I spent over a year on a subcommittee working to unwind all of these surcharges and different places where the fines and fees and so forth go. And then here we are undoing it and going back to creating surcharges again. But one of the unintended consequences of the bill that we had before, after that long work section, was that by taking the first money off of a fine or fee, we ended up starving the cash flow for justice of the peace and municipal courts. So I'll be a no.
Additional discussion? Representative Smith.
Thank you. Mr. Coacher, I'm going to be a yes on House Bill 4093, but I think we have to be careful. Those who have an opportunity to benefit through new facilities or upgrading facilities are also the ones that are going to be controlling whether or not the surcharge gets assessed. And that makes me uneasy a little bit that perhaps there's an incentive to assume a violation or a traffic offense because there's a $5 incentive with everyone that's assessed. And I think we just have to be careful of that.
Additional discussion. I just wanted to get a clarification from Mr. Rocco, just for the record. First, I know this whole issue is the criminal fines and assessments. Any of you that ever have to get into this, I hope you don't. I think Representative Buckley and I and others here have spent years on this issue. What I wanted to get on the record is, one, we had an issue about this money being collected coming out first before the state received its portion of the funds. That has been corrected in the bill, correct? Correct? Mr. Bender?
Mr. Co-Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Bender with the Legislative Fiscal Office. Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, the Public Safety Subcommittee amended the bill to make collection of the $5 surcharge the last $5 that are collected on the fine.
Okay, so it's the last $5.
Correct.
Secondarily, and I think everyone understands this, this fund would only be collected in that court's jurisdiction. That's correct.
That is correct.
Okay. Yes. Representative Whitson.
I was wondering if the $5 fine on parking violations, what is the typical cost of a parking violation?
I don't want to admit.
Oh, I can check it. Nicely done, Mr. Co-Chair.
I think in Portland now it's about $39 for really a basic parking violation. Yes, so, Mr. Bender, do you want to clarify?
Yes, thank you. There's a broad range of parking violation fines, but on average, it's $78. That's the information we got from OJD. The $39 is parking, over parking at a meter.
Yeah.
That's a more basic phone.
For the period of full disclosure here, I average about one every 3 years in Portland. It's almost inevitable. They're not quite as good as the people in Salem that
they're
patrol them.
Yeah, they're very good.
Yeah. I don't think there are anything like that.
I think
the last year was
$50
or something.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Senator
Whitson.
Thank you.
This bill had been amended, and that's one of the major reasons that I would be in opposition to it. His first $5 is now the last $5, as I understand.
Yeah,
I think.
Okay. Any additional? Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question. As I was sitting here, and before somebody in the audience throws something at me, but I'm recalling toward the end of last session, and sitting on the front row were some wonderful Multnomah County folks talking our subcommittee or this committee into diverting monies from red light camera tickets or something like that. Am I remembering? So is this yet another scheme? Is such a terrible word, but is this another way of building more finances or what?
Actually, I think they're actually separate issues. They're completely separate issues. I think the issue, if we were in a committee, both sides of this equation will have to come up with some creative ways to pay for the cost of the bonding for courthouses. Multnomah County has to come up with some creative ways to pay for its portion of the cost, which is quite high. Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Huffman, the red light cameras with the City of Portland.
City of Portland. Thank you. I'm good then.
just no problem. Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion before the committee? Representative Whitsitt and Representative Rayfield. And,
from the lower table.
And on the Senate side, I see none. Motion carries. Close out work session, open work session 1510 relating transportation. Senator Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On February 23rd, the Transportation Economic Development Subcommittee voted to recommend approval of Senate Bill 1510 with amendments. This measure adjusts maximum vehicle weights set in the Oregon statute to align with new federal standards for trucks that include certain equipment, primarily garbage trucks, such as natural gas fuel systems, and it specifies that a transit district may use certain sources of funds other than constitutionally restricted gas tax revenues for construction, improvement, repair, maintenance, operation, and use of secondary transit supportive systems. The A8 amendment added an additional authorizing statute for revenue bonds that can be issued by a local transit district and clarifies that the type of bond proceeds that may be used for projects on secondary transit supportive systems. The Transportation Economic Development Subcommittee recommends 1510 be amended by the 8th Amendment and be reported out due pass as amended. Now, some of the projects that this could be used for include along Highway 217, I-205 near the Abernathy Bridge, the Rose Quarter Interchange, roads adjacent to a transit line, sidewalks in East County where access to transit is difficult because the sidewalks are lacking, or they're not there, safe routes to school improvements that aren't on a transit line. This is all legal and within the realm of the state's requirement that these monies be used for specific purposes. I would urge your aye vote.
Okay. Discussion of the motion before the committee. Yes, Senator Whitsitt. Could this, Senator Rod.
Could this source of revenue be used to fund a bridge across the Columbia River? And since it's allowed to, since the source of revenue is allowed to be bonded as a revenue bond, it would seem to fit right into that possibility.
Is that a rhetorical question?
No, it's a question. Could it be used to build a bridge across the Columbia River, or at least halfway across the Columbia River?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Woodson, yes.
Thank you.
Senator Girard.
Colleagues, this started in business and transportation on the Senate side. And this is one of those, don't put a relating clause in that you don't expect everybody to jump in on. The original bill wasn't in here. So what happened is TriMet put a bill in and the truckers put a bill in. The trucker bill is a really good bill. The TriMet bill, I tried to help them. I wanted to put some sideboards in. The sideboards were never adopted. This, there's no bonding limits. There's no debt to equity ratios that are required. It's an open door to just freely bond. And I'm sorry, but I can't do that. Metro already has this authority. So you're undermining Metro if you want TriMet to get this bill, or you really truly are. And TriMet, like I said, we sent an amendment down there that allowed a debt to equity or debt to revenue stream of 7.5. They informed me they never go over 6. They would not adopt the amendment and they would not accept it. So this is you just can't give people an open door to bond whatever they want without any oversight. And so I'm a no.
Okay. Additional discussion? Any objections to the motion before the committee? Please note Senator Hansel, Senator Thompson, Senator Girard, Senator Whitsitt, Representative Whitsitt, Representative McLean, Representative Smith. Motion carries. Close that work session, open a work session, SB 1515 relating to child welfare. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. On February 24th, the Human Services Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of Senate Bill 1515 with amendments. Senate Bill 1515 makes statutory changes to improve the accountability of both the Department of Human Services and child caring agencies. These agencies care for children in Proctor foster homes or other care settings. The bill does not affect certified foster homes. The bill sets out licensing criteria and other standards for child caring agencies, along with establishing conditions for full compliance and specifying actions DHS can take if a program is found to be out of compliance. For these providers, the bill expands the definition of child to include 18 to 20-year-olds and creates a specific definition of child abuse. Failure to investigate or take other action may be grounds for DHS official misconduct. The bill requires DHS to report on substantiated findings as well as on the feasibility of national accreditation and a center for continuous improvement for providers. The subcommittee amendment adds $369,031 to general fund, $272,677 other funds, and $253,564,000 federal funds to cover 2015-17 costs. This supports an investigator and two licensing staff for DHS and an attorney at the Department of Justice. Changes are effective mid-biennium, so costs for 2017-19 will be higher. The Human Services Subcommittee recommends Senate Bill 1515 be amended by the -A8 amendment and be reported out due pass as amended.
Any discussion of the motion before the committee? Any objection to the motion before the committee? Seeing none, motion carries. We will go on, close that work session, open the work session SB 1559 relating to the regulation of persons who sell products that cannot be sold to persons under the age of 18. Senator Steiner Hayward.
Before we start, I'd like to take credit for the best related clause of the session. On February 25th, the Capital Construction Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of SB 1559 with amendments. SB 1559 requires qualified entities selling tobacco products or inhalant delivery systems to be licensed by the Department of Revenue beginning January 1st, 2017. The agency is to establish license fees at a rate that covers their own cost for administering the program and the cost of the Oregon Health Authority, which is the agency responsible for performing inspections and providing education and outreach. The fiscal impact to the Department of Revenue is minimal and can be absorbed within their budget. The fiscal for the Oregon Health Authority is estimated at $742,267 other funds, primarily to cover the cost of 11 positions to do inspections. Sufficient fee revenue is expected to be available to cover costs of both agencies. The proposed amendment makes changes related to discipline, caps the licensure fee at $300 until February 1st, 2017, requires annual reporting, and makes a number of technical changes. It also includes the other fund expenditure limitation for the Oregon Health Authority. The Capital Construction Subcommittee recommends SB 1559 be amended by the -A13 amendment and be reported out due pass as amended.
Discussion of the motion before the committee. Senator Johnson.
I have a question. I don't know whether it's the professional staff that can answer this, but my question has to do with whether or not what's the scope of the preemption? My concern with this is whether or not if I own a small grocery store near a school and I sell the school, I sell the little store, does the preemption apply to the premises or the license? Am I out of business if I change ownership of the little store?
Yes.
Or out of business as far as selling cigarettes or cigarette-related products?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Linda Ames, I do not know the answer to that question. I do know that there is a grandfather, you know, preemption for near school districts, but exactly how that works on sale, I cannot address.
Okay. This is a pretty important question for me. I am quite concerned about the possibility that small businesses go out of business as far as that line of product sales. And if it comes time to vote on this bill, the absence of an answer on this pivotal question may cause me to be a courtesy yes today, but I'm not bound on the floor. This is a pretty important question.
For the record, can we get that answered by Ledge Council before the bill goes to either chamber?
Yeah. Certainly.
Yes, I hear my letter.
That's okay. I'll just let it keep going.
Yes. More questions down here. Senator Girard.
The question I have is, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought vaping was something used by people to try very hard to get off cigarettes, and I'm trying to understand why we're going after vapers in this bill.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I may, thank you. Thank you, Senator Girard, for that question. There is some suggestion that some people are using vaping to get off of cigarettes, and that it's certainly preferable to have people vape than to use cigarettes. However, I would say two things. The first is that we do not yet know about harms that may be caused by the other chemicals that are present in the substances that are inhaled by e-cigarettes or other inhalant delivery systems. The second point that I would make is that the rate of increased use of these among people under 18, despite the fact that this body passed a bill prohibiting that last year, is remarkably higher than the increase in the rate for people of rate of use of tobacco in that age group because, frankly, they're easier to conceal. The nicotine in these substances, in these vape devices, is just as addictive as the nicotine in tobacco. And further, we know that the nicotine effect on young brains is just as dangerous as it is in the long term. So our goal with this, Senator, is not to prohibit or prevent any adult who wishes to transition from tobacco to a somewhat safer option, i.e. an inhalant delivery system, to prevent that, but rather to prevent children from becoming addicted and starting a habit that may lead to a lifetime of unintended health consequences and challenges with brain development.
Additional discussion, Senator Thompson.
I've got a question on page 6 of the bill, sub 4. It says, I was wondering if you could help me understand this one.
Yes.
I don't know if it's intended to, it's part of the bill just above it, but the sub four says, the authority may impose a fee on a person that engages in the wholesale or retail sale of tobacco products or inhaler delivery systems if the authority conducts a second or a subsequent inspection within a specific time period as set forth in the penalty schedule adopted pursuant. A fee imposed under the subsection must be reasonably calculated to pay the cost of conducting the inspection. So are these inspections solely if there is a violation, or can these be inspected once a day, once a week, once a month? Could somebody explain that?
Senator Steyer, do you want to go first?
I can try, Mr. Co-Chair. Senator Thompson, thank you for your question. To the best of my understanding, there was never any intention, and certainly I personally, as one of the chief sponsors of this bill, never had any intention to do unreasonable amounts of inspection on any lawful business. The general structure is intended to model what OLCC does for businesses having alcohol licenses, which is to say, random inspections, and if there's a violation, then there may be subsequent inspections if need be. But personally, Senator, if I heard that any agency enforcing this legislation was conducting random inspections on an ongoing basis to a business that hadn't had a violation, I would be outraged, and I would take personal responsibility for calling the agency on that. It's not my intention with this bill. My intention is that law-abiding businesses should have nothing to fear from this legislation.
Shields and Hansel.
Senator Shields, and then Senator Hansel, and then Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I do appreciate all the hard work that's gone into this, and that's why I will be a courtesy yes in committee to allow the bill to go forward. I may change my mind once it gets to the floor, because I, too, am concerned about the preemption clause. And my concern is around, while the grandfathering on the surface looks good, if you have an existing small business vape shop, for example, and your lease is up, and then your lease is not renewed by your landlord, or it's increased 30%, you have to move, then you have to get a new license. And I'm not sure, in fact, I'm pretty sure that grandfathering in will not apply to the new address. That is a concern of mine. And I'm also concerned about the disparate treatment between big business and small business. Big business seems to get a break here. And I can understand the politics of that sometimes, but it still has some concerns for me.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to address any of these questions if you wish me to. I'm also happy to just leave them on the table. Your call, sir.
Okay. Let me go to the others. Representative McClain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, I'm going to be a no, not because I don't admire the good work by Senator Hayward in trying to navigate a system, but, you know, a couple of reasons. This is fairly complex, and its consequences are quite extraordinary when you start adding up all the if-then conditionals of the bill. We're in a short session. I'm not sure everyone's come to the plate. Second of all, I represent a district that may have per capita more, you know, less than 5,000 square foot offerings of groceries in the like than anywhere else in the state. And so I think I'm not the only one to recognize that this may not be a proportionate application. But finally, I'm troubled by this mechanism that the agency can sort of set the fines later without legislative review. One of the few powers we have is over the budget, and one of the few semblances of checks and balances and separation of powers is the budget. And I just don't like giving that up. And if we have this agency empowered to reset fines, especially in something as politically volatile as tobacco, I think we're inviting some politics at our agency level knowingly instead of realizing it's there consequentially. So I'll be a no. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On page 6 of the bill, it talks about the health authority is going to provide education and outreach to the public. Is this a duplication of the tobacco education account that we have now, and what will happen to those funds?
Up to you,
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. My understanding is that this would be education and outreach relating to their licensees and how they can stay compliant and that focus, not really quit smoking kind of candidate.
My first day after Santa.
Still looking to follow up, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm trying to find the section. It talked about medical marijuana, but it doesn't talk about recreational marijuana. Why was recreational marijuana left out? Oh, it's on page 2 about this. It doesn't apply if you're dispensing medical marijuana, but not recreational marijuana.
It has been amended.
I'm just trying to find
page top of the page 2, section 4.
We have Ledge Council in the room.
Okay.
We have Ledge Council in the room.
I'm going to bring Ledge Council up, but before we get started, they would come forward. And then I'm going to go back after the answer to the questions to Senator Hansel and Senator Thompson.
I have one more, Mr. Coacher.
Okay. Do you want to put your other issue on the table?
Yes, sir. The other question I had is this committee should realize two things. Let's don't go out of here as totally against small business after the passed the minimum wage. We're talking about here giving authority to people to raise the fee as the cost goes up. We're talking about adding how many FTEs here? We're adding 12 positions, 11 FTEs, and the cost is $2,079,000. They're saying the fees are going to cover it, so it won't come out of any other expense. But it is coming out of another expense. It's coming out of small business. So I'd definitely be a no for this on this bill, and I still understand why it only mentions medical marijuana and not recreation. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay. To Legislative Council first, let's go back to the basic question. You want to ask your question, Senator Johnson, as you ask.
Yes, please. I'm trying to ascertain whether or not a business can be sold. If a city passes an ordinance and my little business is within X number of feet of a school and I want to sell it to Senator Devlin, does the preemption go with the premises, the brick and mortar, or does the preemption go with the business? And would it be conceivable that my little store could be deprived of the ability to sell cigarettes if there is a sale or a transfer?
So premises is defined in the bill in section 1, I believe. I'll read from the definition.
I'll identify yourself for the record.
Oh, please. Sorry. Mark Mayer, Legislative Council. Co-chairs Devlin and Buckley, co-vice chair Senator Johnson, to answer your question. Premises is defined in section 1 of the bill, means a business that makes retail sales of tobacco products or inhalant delivery systems. So even though we're using a term that generally indicates the land itself or the brick and mortar, we have defined it to mean the business. So if there is a sale of business or a change of ownership between one owner and another, and one business effectively ends, another business effectively begins, then the preemption would not carry forward with that. However, if there is some sort of transaction where the business itself as a business entity were to be passed along, then the preemption would still not affect that business. Does that make sense, Senator?
Yes and no. I think my problem is this bill, in my view, has been lobbied so badly with so much conflicting information that those of us that are trying hard to make sense of it are getting ping-pong back and forth between lawyers with different interpretations of what premises means. This is one of these bills, I forget who on the House side made the observation, but this is so complicated for a short session. It's been amended, I understand, at least to take the emergency clause off. But those of us are struggling to understand the effect on small business. And as Senator Shields observed, the big guys versus the little guys. And I'm just trying to understand what happens to my little corner grocery store if an ordinance is passed in a municipality and I want to sell it to Senator Devlin. And I think you've answered my question that
Correct.
Premises is defined as business and not defined as bricks and mortar.
Correct.
Thank you.
Before we go to the other parties, was there another question? There was a pairing back and forth of something on the top of a certain page. Was
yeah,
there?
I had that one.
You had that question?
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Thompson.
The medical.
Co-chair Devlin.
Marijuana versus recreation.
And getting back to my question, I think I got one part of it answered, but we talk about small business here, but what it says on sub 4, the authority may impose a fee on a person that engages in the wholesale or retail sale. So if something gets sold to an underage person, is that business fined, or is it the person that is hired and is working a shift that gets fined? Because the bill says a person. It doesn't say the business. It doesn't make any reference to that. So who gets the fine? And the subsequent fine and the subsequent fine.
Co-chairs Devlin, Buckley, Senator Thompson, person here picks up the general meaning of person throughout all of Oregon revised statutes, which includes both individuals and entities, including businesses, corporations, any other type of entity that you could think of. So this is the person defined broadly, as you've seen throughout many of our bills and throughout the statutes, to pick up both individuals and entities.
Yes.
So Fred's working for me. He's doing the night shift. And he...
16.
It's my store, and he accidentally sells to an underage, under 18. Do I get fined, or does Fred get fined? Which person gets, or both?
Since it's a single civil penalty... It would be, and I'm going to have to apologize because I don't have the section of law that I really need to refer to here, which is 431A175, which is the substantive provisions. But there was an expansion last session through House Bill 4036, which the substantive provisions against selling to minors used to only apply to individuals. And in that bill, there was a modification to make it so the substantive provisions would apply to both individuals or businesses or other entities that sold to minors. And so by referring back to that section, you pick up both individual and business. So the civil penalty would have to be assessed against one or the other in that situation. But there was an expansion in last session in House Bill 4036 were expanded from individual to both. And I don't have that language in front of me, so I can't reference it. I apologize.
Okay.
Here we go. Well, that was pretty clear.
Yeah, I just got the language here. So the substantive provisions, some apply to both businesses and individuals, and some of them do not. So I'll go ahead and read from some of those to understand exactly what can be violated. It is unlawful to distribute, sell, or allow to be sold tobacco products or inhalant delivery systems to a person under 18 years of age. So that could apply to both a business or a person or an individual. To fail as a retailer to post a notice substantially similar to the notice described in subsection 3 of this section with respect to tobacco products. So that would only be the business. To fail as a retailer to post notice in a location that's clearly visible to the seller and the purchaser of the inhalant delivery system that it's unlawful to sell those particular types of devices to persons under 18 years of age. So again, we're talking about the business there and not the individual. To distribute, sell, or allow to be sold inhalant delivery system if the inhalant delivery system is not labeled in accordance with rules adopted by the authority. So that is not specific. It could be a violation against the individual or the business. Distribute, sell, or allow to be sold an inhalant delivery system if the system is not packaged in child-resistant safety packaging as required by the authority by rule. To distribute, sell, or allow to be sold an inhalant delivery system if that system is packaged in a manner that's attractive to minors as determined by the authority by rule. and to allow to be sold cigarettes in any form other than a sealed package. Those last three, it seems as if they're broad enough that they could apply to the individual, but really it's the retailer who's in charge of making sure that things are packaged correctly, labeled correctly, and sealed correctly if they're cigarettes. So does that answer your question, Senator?
I think it did. So is this license that this bill would do, is it who buys a license? The business or the person? Like, does each person that works there have to have a license?
No.
Is it one entity business? So, but is the license go to the business or the person or the owner? How's that work?
Senator Thompson, the premises must be licensed. So whatever, there might be a variety of different businesses that occupy the premises, okay, or that are the business. Sole proprietorship, LLC, limited liability partnership, et cetera. Whatever type of business is selling the product would have to acquire the license.
The business.
Follow-up, Senator Thompson?
Specific location, so... you know, there's a bunch of Pie Pantries, there's a bunch of Safeways. You buy one for all of those?
No, you would buy one per location.
Senator Hansel and then Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate the work that the authors, particularly Senator Hayward, has put on this. I realize we've got a problem that we're trying to fix. Or regulation. I think it relates partially to the fact that it's a major bill, and I wish we had more time to work on it to get it down. I think we could get to a place where we could answer some of these questions. I share Senator Johnson's concerns about small business and others that have raised it. So I'm kind of taking a different track than what she had said earlier. I'll be a courtesy no, I guess, and with the possibility of things could be worked out to be a yes later on. But I just, there's just too many unanswered questions right now for me to be supporting. Okay.
Senator Whitsitt, then Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The A7 and A13 amendment both remove the emergency clause, and I'm assuming if we're adopting the A13, this takes the emergency clause off the bill.
Correct.
I mean, there are several reasons for doing that. The sponsor may want to allow it to be referred. The sponsor may want to allow time for rules to be adopted and so forth. But it's also possible that this bill has been determined to be a bill for raising revenue or a bill for regulating revenue. So, Mr. Mayor, is this bill, in either case, in your opinion, a bill for regulating revenue or raising revenue?
Co-Chairs Devlin, Buckley, Senator Whitsitt, this is not a bill for raising revenue. The only mechanism by which money is coming into the state treasury in this bill is through the fee that is imposed. And part of the jurisprudence for a bill raising revenue, of course, is that if it is a fee that inures to the benefit of the fee payer, which in this case it would, because it would allow you to participate in the sale of e-cigarettes or tobacco products, then it is not a bill for raising revenue. So this is not a bill for raising revenue. There is one line in the bill that makes it a bill for regulating taxation, and that is on page 3, line 4. We gave the Department of Revenue, which there is no taxation on retail sales yet, but we gave the Department of Revenue the ability to impose a civil penalty if a retailer violates a state law or rule related to taxation. And our office, upon closer examination, just felt like we needed to amend it to have the 91-day clause because of that line. But it is not a bill for raising revenue.
Thank you. Okay. And I would just point out, Mr. Co-Chair, that we already have at least 13 laws in 4 different chapters regulating tobacco.
Representative Whitney.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I mentioned this briefly, and the comments that were just made, Department of Revenue thinks they'll have enough fee revenue to pay their cost of about $60,000 and $50,000. But Oregon Health Authority needs to collect, and they have 19 people that are going to be out there picking places because they have to recover enough fees, taxes, penalties, or whatever you want to call them, to pay $2 million a year salaries for 11 FTEs. There was 12 positions, 11 FTEs. So, and I'm disappointed that the revenue department has not given us a revenue impact. I think some of these things proposed in this bill could tell people it's not worth selling tobacco. We need the revenue from tobacco. How much is it, Mr. Co-Chair? It's a lot of money. Thank you. I'll be definitely in.
Senator Steiner.
Senator Johnson.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Mayor, if the Dash 12s were not included, would you still find the little businesses in jeopardy, or would they be relieved of the jeopardy of the transfer of the business?
The Dash 12s, Co-Chairs Devlin Buckley, Co-Vice Chair Senator Johnson. The Dash 12s are the, if you would remind me, they are the ones that include the grandfather clause?
Yes.
Thank you. So I can talk about what these do on their face. As to whether or not they jeopardize small businesses, I think that's a policy question for the committee to consider. What these do is they say that local governments may not impose ordinances on larger businesses, businesses that have a footprint of 5,000 square feet or more. With regard to where those businesses may be located with respect to a school or a public place. So it really only makes a carve out for that particular prohibition. In the current bill, there's a prohibition against local ordinances imposing a foot requirement on these businesses from schools or public places. Here we've carved out the larger businesses and the smaller businesses. Local ordinances would be able to impose ordinances on them. However, we did also specify that any city or county that adopts such an ordinance, that ordinance will only apply prospectively. It cannot apply retroactively. So that if there is a business that is currently in existence, then that business would be allowed to continue to sell products at that location.
Until there's a sale or a transfer of the business.
Correct. If a business changes hands in some significant way, then it may fall out of the preemption clause, depending on how the transfer occurs.
Yep. Will you allow me one more question on
that? Yes.
If the transfer occurs within a family or within a corporate structure, would that offer an existing corporate structure? Would that allow a different level of protection than a stranger-to-stranger sale?
Correct. Yes.
So within a current corporate structure or a familial line, you could maintain the grandfathered preemption?
I would think correct. If the transfer is done correctly, I would say yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apologies to Senator Steiner Hayward. I was a yes this morning. In capital construction, there's been a lot more discussion here. The water has now gotten too muddy to swim in, so apologies. I'm going to be a no on this. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Steiner Hayward, did you want this? You're in the queue.
Sorry.
Then I'll go to you, Senator.
I'd rather, if it's okay, I'd rather speak last so I can address everything. But if
Senator
not,
Durant.
It's your call, Mr.
Yes.
Chair.
Tobacco products. I hate to ask this question, and it might be just a rhetorical question, but nicotine patches are basically a tobacco product. So would this bill involve nicotine patches?
Co-Chairs Devlin, Buckley, Senator Girard, no, it would not. Tobacco products, for purposes of this bill, it uses the definition in ORS 431A175, and it is a pretty extensive list, but it is primarily cigarettes, cigars, and other types of recreational inhalants. Not Not FDA-approved products, Senator Girod.
Well, then that brings up the question, is marijuana included?
Senator Girod, no, it is not. If you look at Section 4...
Give me a break.
The provisions of the Act do not apply to a person making a retail sale of an inhalant delivery system at a medical marijuana dispensary registered under ORS 475B450 or a premises for which a retail license has been issued under ORS 475B110 unless the person makes a retail sale of an inhalant delivery system that contains nicotine. That is a reference to both the medical marijuana dispensary registration statute and the recreational marijuana licensing statute. So as long as they're only selling vape pens and stuff like that, they only have to acquire the single license. It's only if they're also going to sell nicotine products that they would have to acquire dual licenses.
Colleagues, I'm going to go to Senator Steiner. Hayward wants to be last. I'm going to go to Senator Thompson. But we have spent 35 minutes on this bill. We were going relatively well. If we spend this much time on the remaining bills, I will have you out of here by about 10:30 tonight. So I'm going to go to Senator Thompson, and then I'm going to go to Senator Steiner Hayward.
Okay, I'm in the paragrowing business, and what we do is pass most farmers try to pass our family business on to our family and kids. Can you tell me what page and what line it's on that says that this license is transferable so that if I own this store and I want to give it to my son Fred, and
that's about right.
can I transfer that license to him? Can he get his own and maintain my license of selling tobacco close to the school or whatever? What line is that on? So I want to be sure that's very important.
Co-chairs Devlin, Buckley, Senator Thompson. Again, it's because of the definition of premises and it being a business. And so if the business continues in existence, the grandfather clause will continue to apply to it. If, however, the business is sold and effectively terminated and a new business is formed for purposes of maintaining sales at that location, then the grandfather clause would no longer apply. So I think Co-Vice Chair Senator Johnson's earlier examples are great examples of a corporate structure where the business would continue to belong within the corporate structure. Or the example that I had was the same as her other example for other people earlier, which was within a familial line where it was just a continuation of the same business. If it continues as a single business, the grandfather clause would continue to apply.
I'm going to go to Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, I want to try to address... I want to address some of the concerns that have been raised. And I apologize if I miss some. I'll do my best. And I want to thank Mr. Mayor for his explanations. The first thing I want to say is this. I appreciate the concerns that this is a short session bill. I would remind many of you that, or advise many of you that you may not have been aware, this bill was worked very heavily in the 2015 session as well. We got very close to an agreement at the end of session and kind of ran out of time, but we were really, really close. Senator Amanda Sanderson then ran a very inclusive, broad-based work group with people across the spectrum. People from small businesses and large businesses were invited. Some chose to attend, some chose not to. And we tried very hard to accommodate a lot of the concerns. There is, for example, a preemption in this bill that nobody's commented on that prohibits local jurisdictions from banning sales of tobacco or inhalant delivery systems in stores that also contain retail pharmacies. So that protects your Rite Aids and your Walgreens and any other pharmacy, and it protects the grocery stores that have pharmacies in them, which is many of them. And we were respectful of the fact that that would be a problem for many of those businesses. That was something that the anti-tobacco folks really wanted us to take out, and we said no. I would also point out that the distance prohibition that local jurisdictions could apply in response to Representative McLean's concerns only happen if a local jurisdiction chooses to pass such an ordinance. And at that point, they can choose the distance. Some people might choose 250 feet, which is about one city block, and some people might choose 1,000 feet, which is four city blocks. And some jurisdictions will probably choose not to pass any ordinances about this whatsoever. And that's something that local communities control and the local businesses can have their say in. And that's how it should be. And that's why we dealt with it that way. I appreciate the concerns about whether this fee could skyrocket and that it's not in statute. We added what was the Dash 7 and is incorporated into the Dash 13s to provide fee certainty for the first year and to make it crystal clear that the Department of Revenue has to be able to justify in its rules any fee increase. And again, colleagues, I don't have a boatload of power as one lowly legislator, but I will commit to you personally and publicly that I will do my darndest to hold the agency accountable, both DOR and the health authority and anybody else whose work might be contributing to a fee increase if it's considered unreasonable. To address Representative Wisnant's concerns about the total cost, the cost estimated by the health authority plus the cost by the DOR totals almost exactly the estimate of what would be taken in fees by a $300 license fee by the estimated number of businesses that would need this kind of license in the state, the biennial cost. So that $2 million, Representative, would be totally covered by the planned $300 fee to the best of our ability. Currently, the state puts $200,000 annually into tobacco inspection and control. That cost would go away, to the best of my understanding. Further, a concern that has been raised by many is that our tobacco enforcement measures in the state are spread across multiple agencies and multiple jurisdictions. This bill would allow those to finally be consolidated and provide some consistency and understandable expectations for business owners, which I think is only fair, just as those who hold liquor licenses can have an unreasonable expectation that there will be consistency of enforcement because one agency controls it. Further, I would point out that there will not, as Ms. Ames said, be a duplication of education. Instead, it is intended to focus primarily on educating retailers and also on educating the public about the effects of this bill, not about tobacco prevention. I would point out that Oregon is one of only 8 states in the nation that does not require a license for retailers to sell tobacco. And as a result, primarily of that, we have one of the highest rates of sales to minors in the nation. Colleagues, if we care about keeping Oregon's tobacco costs, related costs, health costs down in the future, and preventing that, if we care about supporting the military, who say that tobacco is one of their biggest threats to readiness, and which is why they are enforcing Hawaii's Tobacco 21 rule when they don't have to because they're separate. They could stick at 18, but they're supporting Tobacco 21. Then this is one of the things that will get us to that place of protecting children from this highly addictive substance. Finally, I would point out that 3 counties and 8 cities already have passed tobacco licensure bills, tobacco retail licensure ordinances, which means that businesses that operate in multiple jurisdictions have to deal with multiple different licensure systems. This bill would preempt local jurisdictions from requiring a second license and would simplify things for businesses. Yes, they would have to get a separate license for each one of their premises, as Mr. Mayor pointed out. So the Safeway on Cornell Road would be different from the Safeway on Beaverton Hillsdale Highway, but it would be the same process. And the Department of Revenue has made it clear that they will try to make it as simple as the Secretary of State's Corporations Division has, so that it's a matter of clicking and adding an additional address. And the intention, and by the next year, for those of you who think, well, let's do this in 2017, there are at least 5 to 10 more jurisdictions that will probably have passed ordinances. The genie will be out of the bottle, and at that point, it's going to be too late. So if we want to provide a little bit of consistency statewide, and if we want to understand that we need to be protecting kids from these addictive substances and avoiding the long-term health costs, then that's what this bill will do. I understand the concerns about small businesses. We try very hard to put in reasonable protections.
I have actually two more members that are urgently wanting to either make statements or have a question. And at that point, we will go to a vote. So Senator, I guess Representative McLean was first, and then I'll go to Senator Johnson.
All right. Well, to the chair and Senator Steiner Hayward, we have a rule in the House where we don't ascribe motives for votes. And I just want to at least put out a word of caution that the statement that if you care about kids or the like, in ascribing that the only way to fulfill that condition is a yes vote on this bill would garner a rebuke by our speaker. And so I just want to, and I'm sure you didn't mean to say that my no vote here means I don't care about kids, but I just want to caution that it could sure be interpreted based upon your statements, passionately given, that our motives were in question. And so I just think it's important on this bill and other bills that we don't ascribe to each other motives for a no vote or a yes vote.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative McLean, I apologize. You are completely correct. I did not mean to ascribe motives. I wasn't clearing my language, and I apologize. And I thank you for saying something. Thank you very much, Representative.
Senator Johnson.
The more people talk about this bill, the less I like it. I have a question, Mr. Mayor. Senator Steiner-Hayward made the assertion, or at least I thought she did, that only one agency would now be in charge. So does this now take any other agencies out from doing stings? Is DOR still going to do audits? One of the complaints that I hear from my small business people is that many of the DOR auditors don't understand the business of retail tobacco sales. But help me understand at this point, does this bill consolidate all agency activities in the Oregon Health Authority?
Co-chairs Devlin and Buckley, co-vice chair Senator Johnson, it does not. What it does is it creates a licensing program for DOR, and then it specifically directs DOR to regulate tobacco licensure with respect to taxation purposes. My understanding, and a representative from DOR would probably be better at this than me, is to explain this to me, is that they have data that they can collect by licensing retailers that would allow them to basically monitor and track the activity of wholesalers, where our Oregon tax is imposed much better. Again, a representative from DOR would probably be much better at answering that. The bill also creates a bright line and says Oregon Health Authority will continue to monitor and investigate these businesses for public health and safety purposes. It does remove from statute one required type of investigation. And then my understanding is that because the Oregon Health Authority acquired the FDA grant for purposes of conducting FDA investigations, that there will be now three investigations that OHA will conduct underneath different programs that are tied to different types of federal monies. So DOR will be doing taxation type stuff. OHA will be doing public health and safety type stuff. But there are going to be fewer investigations, but there are still multiple investigations tied to different types of federal monies that OHA will be conducting. Does that help answer your question?
It does.
We will go to a roll call vote.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Mayor, thank you very much. And Mr. Mayor, if you could stay here for a moment, I would appreciate it. Anywhere in the... Mr. Rocker.
Okay, Representative Kopp.
Aye.
Representative Wisman?
Nay.
Representative Huffman?
No.
Representative McLean?
No.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Williamson?
Aye.
Representative Gomberg?
Aye.
Representative Rayfield?
Yes.
Representative Whitson?
No.
Co-Vice Chair Smith?
I mean, yes, but I'm a courtesy yes at this.
Co-Vice Chair Nathanson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Buckley?
Aye.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Whitson?
No.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Gerard?
Nope.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Senator Hansel?
No.
Senator Roblin?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Johnson?
This is an inappropriate bill for a short session. It's a zombie bill from 2015. My vote decides this bill today. I will give it a courtesy yes out of this committee, but with no representations to the floor.
Co-Chair Devlin?
Yes.
Motion carries.
Motion carries. Mr. Meyer, if you're still in the room, if I know how hard Legislative Council has been working, I recognize that. But when this bill comes up for third reading in the first chamber, which I believe will be the Senate, can you have a broad answer to that issue about transfer of the business between various parties so that that can be clarified?
Including another legal construct like an LLP or an LLC.
Could I add to that, too? If you're an independent or individual owner of it and you change to a corporation in order to transfer, is that a change in ownership or a change? I need to have that answered.
Okay. I think Mr. Mayor understands. So with that, we'll close that work session. We'll open a work session. SB 1569, relating to the Joint Committee on the Legislative Assembly.
On February 24th, the General Government Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of Senate Bill 1569. Senate Bill 1569 establishes the Joint Legislative Policy and Research Committee, which will be composed of an equal number of majority and minority party members of each chamber. Duties of the staff of the committee will include conducting research, facilitating policy development, and providing assistance and advice. Some current duties of the Legislative Administration Committee will be transferred to the new committee, along with the associated staffing and funds. Additional funds needed for the new committee will be included in the 2017-19 budget as the measure becomes effective July 1st, 2017. The General Government Subcommittee recommends Senate Bill 1569 be reported out due pass.
Discussion of the motion before the committee. Yes, Senator Johnson.
A committee that's never existed before, once again subject to an emergency clause.
Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion before the committee? Seeing none, motion carries. Okay, open a work session 1582 relating to Housing and Community Services Department. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On February 22nd, the Transportation and Economic Development Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of Senate Bill 1582 with amendments. 1582 creates the Local Innovation and Fast Track, or LIFT, housing program to be developed and implemented by the Housing and Community Services Department with direction to the Oregon Housing Stability Council. LIFT will build new affordable housing for low-income families, financed with $40 million in bonds pursuant to Article 9Q of the Constitution that were authorized during the 2015 session. The intent of Senate Bill 1582 is to provide high-level guidance about how the department will execute the LIFT program, including specifications on how the agency will comply with the constitutional requirements to own or operate the properties financed with the bond proceeds. Stakeholders have been engaged to design a program that seeks to contain costs, maximize the number of units, serve geographically diverse areas of the state, and serve clients in the Department of Human Services system. General fund in the amount of $169,350 is included to allow Housing and Community Services to fund a limited duration position related to program development, project review and underwriting, and permanent part-time accounting position for the 2015-17 biennium. The Transportation and Economic Development Subcommittee recommends Senate Bill 1582 be amended by the -82 amendments and be reported out due pass as amended.
Okay. Discussion of the motion before the committee. Yes, Senator, or Representative Whitson.
I just had a comment that I would like to see what the cost per square foot of this is going to be, if we have a limit, an upper limit on square footage of the housing, whoever's making the determination of
Do we have an LFO analyst here, Cheryl?
Yes, sir. I'm going to give a courtesy, yes.
Senator Whitson, I don't believe it's specified, or Representative Whitson, I don't believe it's specified, but I'd like to get an answer on the record.
Co-chairs, Representative Whitson, Michelle Dicer, Legislative Fiscal Office, I don't believe it is specified in the bill either. I do believe that Housing and Community Services will be prepared to report on the projects that are selected once they are, and we'll have specific information with regard to the projects that are selected.
Okay. Follow-up. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'll provide a courtesy yesterday. I'm really concerned about how one person is going to be a high-level guidance about executing this program and talk about best constitutional requirement to operate operate the properties financed with the bond procedures. I hope there'll be a lot of input or comments that or expertise and input from other people that one position is going to obtain. This is a big project, a needed project that I support, low-cost housing. In my district, we need a lot of it. The director, I have a lot of confidence in, but we've spent a lot of money in Deschutes County, and we still are putting it into the state and not getting our fair share back to address this issue, I don't believe. Thank you.
Yes, Representative McClain.
I'll be a courtesy no for the reasons by Representative Wisner. I need to be honest. There is some stuff in here that I just didn't ask Michelle about, and I'm a little flat-footed here, but I guess I'm defaulting to being a courtesy no, and then maybe we'll follow up. Thank you.
Any additional discussion?
No such thing.
Okay, objections to the motion. Representative Whitsitt, Representative McClain, Senator Whitsitt, motion carries. Close out work session, open a work session, SB 1586, related to voting needs. On February 24th, the General Government Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of SB 1586 with amendments. The bill directs the Secretary of State to ensure that there is at least one location designated as an official ballot drop site within 4 miles of the main campus of public universities and community colleges.
No.
Public universities and community colleges are directed to increase voter registration, access, and information by undertaking the following. First, to display a link on school websites to the Secretary of State's voter registration tool. Second, to give student government an opportunity to provide nonpartisan voter registration information during orientations, welcome events, and resident life activities. Three, provide contact information of school faculty that permit nonpartisan voter classroom presentations. Four, provide opportunities for students to offer nonpartisan voter registration services. And five, work with local county elections offices prior to elections to obtain address information of students living in campus housing and schools must provide to receive ballots and make information available to schools, official student government. The General Government Subcommittee recommended SB 1586 be amended by the -A7 amendment and be responded out to due pass. In way of closing on this particular bill, I would point out that there were originally two bills put into one bill. One bill is no longer there, and there is nothing in this bill on postage.
Good.
Discussion of the motion before the committee. Senator Girard.
Yeah. I might be wrong, but I think this bill is really illegal. You have taken one class of voters that you want to prioritize over the other class of voters. Now, it could be seniors. We could do it for Republicans, but you have chose students. And it really bothers me because I think there's political motivation here. And so I am an ardent no vote on this, even though I think I'm probably one of the few people in this committee that can honestly say that I've done just about everything I can for students. But I do think it's illegal, and I think you're prioritizing a certain class to vote.
Additional discussion.
Bernie needs some.
Objections to the motion before the committee. Senator Hansel, Senator Girard, Senator Whitsitt, and Representative Whitsitt. Motion carries. Close that work session, go to SB 1587, relating to wages, Representative Buckley.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On February 22nd, the Natural Resources Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of Senate Bill 1587 with amendments. Senate Bill 1587 requires employers to include specific itemized information on payroll statements to employees, defines time and pay records, and requires the employer to maintain records of current and terminated employees as required by the Fair Labor Standards Act regulation. The bill authorizes the Commission of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to expend certain monies from the Wage and Security Fund to administer and enforce provisions of wage and hour and minimum wage laws. The bill increases the other fund expenditure limitation from the Wage Security Fund by $325,954 to support three permanent full-time positions, 1.89 FTE, within the Wage and Hour Division to investigate and enforce claims of underpaid and unpaid wages. The bill also prohibits contractors or subcontractors from paying the prevailing wage or taking specified actions to avoid the cost of prevailing wage on qualifying projects and prescribes a penalty for violation. The Natural Resources Subcommittee recommends Senate Bill 1587 be amended by a -A6 amendment and be reported out to pass as amended. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Discussion of the motion before the committee. Yes, Senator Whitson.
Thank you. I have a question of LFO or LC or whoever on page 5, line 20, sub A.
Yeah, me too.
In addition, in violation of subsection 1 of this section is a Class C felony. In addition to and not in lieu of any action, the Commission of the Bureau of Labor and Industry may bring the Commissioner may refer a violation of subsection 1 of this section to a district attorney or to the Attorney General for prosecution. Would that, doesn't that take the original jurisdiction away from the district attorney?
Co-chairs, Senator Whitsitt, Michelle Deister, Legislative Fiscal Office, with regard to the specific penalties and et cetera, those things were not discussed before the Natural Resources Subcommittee when this was heard in Ways and Means. I'm not really in a position to answer the specifics of the policy with regard to the penalties, nor do I know the answer with regard to jurisdiction.
Fair enough. I would like to know the answer to that question.
Thank you.
Michelle, can I back up for a second?
Do you know where to go to get that answer?
Co-chairs, I would probably start with the agency and legislative council.
Very good. Bain, would you do that, please?
Yeah, absolutely.
Additional discussion? Any objection to the motion before the committee? Senator Whitsitt, Senator Girard, Representative Whitsitt. Motion carries. Close that work session, open a work session. SB 1596, Governor's Budget Process, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On February 25th, the Capital Construction Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of Senate Bill 1596 with amendments. Senate Bill 1596 revises procedures for the preparation of the Governor's and the legislatively adopted budgets as recommended by the Task Force on State Budget Process, which is charged with reviewing the statutes governing the development of the state budget. Changes include removing outdated or unnecessary provisions, aligning state budget processes with desired outcomes, and clarifying statutory language. The General Government Subcommittee recommends Senate Bill 1596, Capital Construction Subcommittee recommends Senate Bill 1596 be amended by a -3 amendment and be reported out, do pass as amended. Did I get that motion right? Well, it came from the Capital Construction Sub. Correct.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
Was this bill only heard in capital construction?
This is a good question for me to ask. Okay. This bill was heard in a number of committees in the previous session, passed both chambers unanimously, had a slight conflict amendment when it came back to the Senate, and nobody actually noticed that it had come back to the Senate on the final day. And it died. It both passed both chambers. And Senator Whitsitt, former Representative Bob Jensen, Representative Buckley, and myself spent 2 years in committees of 4 or 5 of us, along with some senior staff, going through every single budget line relative to the preparation of the budget as a basically statutory review committee. Did not substantially change the process in any significant way other than taking out archaic language. But actually, if you wanted to watch paint dry, that would have been more fascinating than our meetings. So that's the history of the bill.
It was a blast, Senator. Literally blast.
But that's my...
Thank you.
Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries. We will go on to, this is actually the core of our work. SB 5097, Program Changes. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On February 25th, the Capital Construction Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of Senate Bill 1597 with amendments. The measure makes the necessary changes in statutes and session laws to support the 2015-17 legislatively adopted budget, to clarify the application of statutes for the budget, and to modify provisions relating to the use of funds. Specifically, the measure corrects Oregon Courthouse Capital Construction and Improvement Fund Program statutes to apply program criteria and requirements for courthouse projects, adds requirements for the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, removes loan requirements for the Oregon State Fair, combines Judicial Department technology fee revenue with the State Court Technology Fund, transfers from the former Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to Higher Education Coordinating Commission a specific bonding project not included in the 2015 session legislation, increases annual judicial salaries, creates funds for the History Gateway and the Oregon State Capital Foundation, transfers liquor fund revenue to the Oregon Health Authority for a youth marijuana use prevention pilot program with repayment provision, directs earnings from Oregon growth account investments to be distributed by the same formula and applied to earnings on other monies in the Education Stability Fund. The Capital Construction Subcommittee recommends Senate Bill 1597 be amended by the dash to amendment and reported out to pass as amended. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Discussion. Yes, Representative Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I need to declare a potential conflict of interest. Colleagues, it's that time of year. I'm a member of a limited liability company that does economic development and business development throughout Eastern Oregon. And there's several projects in here that will go to counties that I do work with. Thank you.
Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion before the committee? Seeing none, motion carries. We will go on, close that work session, open a work session if SB 5701, Budget Reconciliation, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On February 25th, the Capital Construction Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of Senate Bill 5701 with amendments. Senate Bill 5701 is the budget reconciliation bill that adjusts the state budget for the 2015-17 biennium. Along with the 2016 session budget decisions, the bill includes technical adjustments and actions recommended by the Interim Joint Committee on Ways and Means. The budget increases the General Purpose Emergency Fund to $32 million and maintains a $40 million special purpose appropriation for potential costs to Oregon Health Authority or the Department of Human Services. After all adjustments, the general fund ending balance is projected to be about $225 million. The special purpose appropriation of $120 million was allocated to state agencies to cover employee compensation costs. It was set aside for this purpose. This is expected to cover about 93% of estimated general fund costs. Lottery funds, other funds, and federal funds are increased to cover the full amount needed. Other actions include, but are not limited to, add $6 million general fund and $5 million in special purpose appropriations for the Department of Corrections for increased inmate population for improved treatment for seriously mentally ill offenders. Leaves the department with a $16 million budget shortfall. Appropriates $24 million general fund to cover the state's share of costs for the 2015 fire season. Provides additional general fund resources to key P-12 education programs, including increasing funding for Oregon pre-kindergarten by $5.3 million, early intervention and early childhood special education by $5.4 million, relief nurseries by $300,000, and $17.5 million for a mixed delivery preschool program. In response to the shooting in October at the Umpqua Community College, this bill provides $4.25 million to repair Snyder Hall where the shootings occurred, and another $1.8 million for security staff, improvements to safety and security systems, and other costs resulting from the incident. Partially balances the Oregon Health Authority budget, leaving one potential issue of $17 million unresolved. The budget also includes $10 million other funds for investments in rural hospital transformation and sustainability. Directly covers a little over half of the projected $71.7 million general fund $1 million general fund deficit for the Department of Human Services. The three remaining caseload forecasts may help lower the agency's request from the special purpose appropriation. Added $2.5 million general fund to significantly expand Oregon Air Toxics Program. Seven budget notes are included in the budget report for this bill. The Capital Construction Subcommittee recommends Senate Bill 5701 be amended by the dash four amendment and be reported out, due pass as amended. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay. Discussion of the motion before the Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs. Both co-chairs, thank you for all your work on this. I know it's not an easy job. I've served on this committee several sessions, and it's a very difficult job. We funded some really good things. I'd like to point out to the people that are, all the people that are watching us on TV and the people here hearing the committee, it's my understanding the total amount of budget reconciliation was about $150 million. I'd like to point out to the people that, as Chair Buckley read, the special purpose appropriation of $120 million was allocated to the state agencies to cover employment compensation costs. So out of the $150 million, $120 million went for raises. And I think we should honor, we have good people, we need to do it. But something seems off. It's not right here. And I know that it's my understanding that that raise did not even come through this body. There's a lot of those good programs that the co-chairs funded. We could have doubled those amounts if, without this $120 million. Thank you.
I have Senator Whitsitt first, and then I'll go to Representative Reed. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. This bill has 115 sections in it. It's, I would characterize it as the mother of all noble furs. I don't even know where to begin, but Section 10, this bill takes $2 million for fire protection away from the Oregon Department of Forestry. And I would certainly like to know first if that money is for, if that $2 million is part of the money that was appropriated to set up pre-suppression equipment and personnel in a for the next year.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, Section 10 disappropriates the money and then it's reappropriated back to the Department of Forestry in Section 8. And the reason we had to do that is because it was part of a special purpose appropriation, which is under the purview of the Emergency Board. And during session, the Emergency Board is inactive. So what we have to do budgetarily is we have to take the money away from the E-Board and then give it to the agencies.
Okay. So if I could follow up, then there's money in here for the Department of Forestry, for Oregon State Police, for the Oregon Department of Transportation, perhaps others for fire, you know, for the fire season. I read on this bill for 2.5 hours and didn't get through it all. So I'm wondering if you could tell us how much money is actually appropriated to various different agencies, you know, reimbursing the Oregon Department of Forestry and so forth for the fire season in one place.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, after this came up during the January Ways and Means meeting, I think, and we started working on a display to show where all the costs were in response to the questions of the committee at that time, the interim committee. So we have that information, and we'll make it available to you.
Thank you.
We just we got busy with other things and didn't, you know, finalize it. But we did collect all the money that was authorized by fund type for the fire season.
That would be helpful. There's a couple other questions. How much money in total is allocated within this bill to increases in employee compensation related to the most recent collective bargaining agreements?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, again, in section... in Section 63, we did appropriate the $120 million that was previously provided for the to the Emergency Board as a special purpose appropriation for that, for employee compensation. There's also a smaller special purpose appropriation that was provided for non-state employees, and that's disappropriated in Section 43. most of that amount. There's a little bit left because they're still working out an agreement. And then in section 116, which you'll see at the big table at the back of the bill, amendment to the bill, includes all the distributions to agencies of that $120 million general fund, along with other funds and federal funds and lottery funds that are also included.
And how much of that, how much is the total? I mean, when you include the other funds and the lottery funds and the... I know there's $120 million in SPA, and I know there's another $10 million for the employees that aren't everyday employees. But what I'm looking at is how much money does this collective bargaining cost?
Mr. Chair, the total for the salary distribution was an additional $3.1 million of lottery funds, $107.8 million of other funds, and $56 million of federal funds, as well as the $120 million of general fund.
I can't add that fast.
Do I want to use my iPhone? I think
roughly about a quarter of a million dollars.
Yes.
$230 or more than that, actually. About $282.90.
What do you got, Gail? Got 314? Let's see if you're right. All right.
56.
We're stuck here without a calculator.
I can go get my abacus for you.
Well, you started with an abacus, well, didn't you?
I think Rep Whitson got 314.
353.3. Or no, 107.8. Yeah. No, you got it. It's 286.
I think it's about 286.
All right.
Okay.
You can check your numbers with Rep Whitson.
Yes.
Mr. Co-Chair, this is probably going to muddy the waters worse, and I missed part of the conversation because I had to call on a patient. But some of that increase was not just increased hourly wages. Because of the K-2 waiver and expansion of hours for people with disabilities and people with and adults with APD, we had a great expansion of the number of hours being worked also, and that affected that cost. It was just increased in hourly wage. It was the number of hours increased, and it was a huge increase in our division of APD and DD. Do you have any idea of how much of it was just from increased hours taken care of some of those vulnerable people in our society? And that may be something you haven't calculated or can't find.
Dear, she's behind you. She snuck up on you.
There goes Karen.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Bates. Actually, the cost associated, other than a portion of the $10.7 million collective bargaining pot for non-state workers, most of the increases you're talking about are actually in the DHS caseload numbers, not in the numbers go directly to employee salaries. It's a different pot of money. And so if I recollect correctly, when the agency came into rebalance in January, between the two divisions, I think there was a shortfall of about $100 million in general fund for those programs. And a big piece of that were related to some of the in-home costs related to hours in those environments.
Thank you. So I thought Senator Whitsitt was in the middle of the... Senator Whitsitt?
Yeah, I had a couple of other questions. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I'm sorry.
But so, Mr. Rocco, would it be safe to say that the roll-up cost would be approximately twice that for the 17-19 biennium? I don't, just in the ballpark.
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt, yes, as was there was a report in the November interim wage and means, and generally, yes, the number was slightly more than twice that amount for the when you include the roll-up cost for the biennium.
One other question before we go on, and that has to do with the state government service charges. Some of these things are absolutely amazing. For OHA, it's an increase of $20 million for, I don't know, I've got it here in my notes, but I mean, there's Department of Human Services, a $41 million increase in state government service charges. There's several others. I mean, what's going on here? When we were when we talked about this in general government, it appeared that the small agencies were going to get large increases, and now we're seeing the large increases, the large agencies getting humongous increases in charges, which all flows to DAS.
That's the question.
Paul.
Here it goes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you on the side of the room.
I mumble, and she's right. She's always right. Anyway, I'm talking about the state government service charges. We have the PERS is being levied another $6.6 million. We're having DHS, I believe, was an increase of $41 million. There was another agency, OHA, had an increase of $20 million in the in this litany. What's going on?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that actually was not in the bill. There was a proposal by DAS that we looked at for redoing the state government service charge for the state data center, but we did not do that in this bill. And we're doing the assessment changes related to the reorganization of IT at DAS, related to the HRIS project going forward, and that will be dealt with in May. There's still a $6.5 million general purpose appropriation, or I mean a special purpose appropriation in the emergency fund.
Are we not dealing with the DAS 4 amendments?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, the DAS 4 amendments, the table in the back, only has the salary pot information in it. We decided after seeing, you may have seen a report that DAS made in your subcommittee about the state government service charges, but that was ultimately that was not included in this bill because we're still looking at that and trying to check out some of the numbers that they have.
Yep, that's okay. Thanks, Chris.
Okay.
Just a second. On just for instance, on page 15, perhaps I'm just totally confused, but on page 15, starting on line 9, it appears that the levy to the public employees' retirement systems increased by $6,601,170 for state government service charges.
Oh. Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt, that one I can explain. That was we're fixing an error from the end of last session when the PERS adjustments for the state government service charges and the state data center were miscalculated. We caught the error at the very end of session. Unfortunately, in the bill that you passed, the limitation was provided, I believe, to non-limited funds when it should have been in limited funds, and so we made that correction in this bill.
Okay. Any additional?
Hey, Smith.
Yes.
Mr. Coacher, I need to declare a conflict of interest. I'm a member of a limited liability company that does business development and economic development in Eastern Oregon. And I work with folks, counties, universities, small businesses who may benefit from this bill.
Agreed to.
Okay. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. There's a lot of good stuff in this bill. I want to draw the committee's attention to perhaps one of the smaller things by numbers, but one of the more significant things, I think, by content. Prior to this session, I knew of one other member of the legislature besides myself who was directly affected by ALS. Now, of course, we have our friend and colleague who is taking that on in a really serious way. But some of us were talking about how we might recognize that. We struggle a little bit. As it turns out, Oregon State University has one of the world's leading ALS researchers on their faculty who is doing some amazing things there. Buried deep within this bill, thanks to the co-chairs and others, you'll find a small amount that we intend to capitalize an endowed scholarship at Oregon State to support a research assistant to Dr. Beckman. We hope it will be an appropriate way to honor our friend and colleague, Representative Gilliam. I hope my House colleagues will tolerate me saying something similar when the bill gets to the House. And my great thanks to the co-chairs for making this possible.
Any additional discussion? Senator Monroe.
I'd like to thank the co-chairs, especially for the portions of this budget that implement early childhood, preschool, and so on. They tried very hard to meet the expectations of Representative Comp and myself on these programs. The more money we spend on early childhood programs today, the more money we save in remedial programs down the pike in our public schools and also in our justice system. So I think this is money well spent.
Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion before the committee? Seeing none?
Wait, hold on a second. You have two. Looks like.
Oh, okay. Objections.
Three.
Senator Thompson, Senator Girard, Senator Whitsitt, and on this side?
We're good.
Motion carries. Close that work session.
I'm sorry.
Oh, and Senator Hansel. Close that work session. Open a work session on 5702 feed ratification. Senator Steiner Haywood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On February 25th, the Capital Construction Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of SB 5702 with amendments. SB 5702 ratifies fee changes approved by the Department of Administrative Services and adopted administratively by the Department of Aviation, the Real Estate Agency, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the Board of Accountancy, and the Board of Medical Imaging. The Department of Aviation restructured tie-down fees at state airports and established fees for publicly owned unmanned aerial systems that are expected to raise $7,560 in 2015-17. The Real Estate Agency increased the land development fee for condominium filings that is expected to raise $169,708 in 2015-17. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission established 19 fees associated with the regulation of marijuana that are expected to raise $5.9 million in 2015-17. The Department of Consumer and Business Services ratified administrative fees charged to insurers participating in the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace that had previously been established by Cover Oregon. These fees are $9.66 per member per month for health insurance plans and 97 cents per member per month for dental insurance plans. The Oregon Board of Accountancy ratified changes to the license fees for accountants and accounting firms that are expected to raise $157,400 in 2015-17. The Oregon Board of Medical Imaging established a fee for physician assistants who perform fluoroscopy. The fees are expected to raise $9,450 in 2015-17. The amendment removes from a printed bill Department of Agriculture fees that are not being ratified at this time. The Capital Construction Subcommittee recommends SB 5702 be amended by the Dash 1 amendment and be reported out due pass as amended. And I would love to know how I got to carry this one since I'm not on Capital Construction.
That's why, Senator.
Senator, you got to carry because I was trying to keep track on Capital Construction of where the fees were located. I think you won the prize because you had the most fees, I think, in the
I will not take personal responsibility for that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Kutcher. I'm going to support Senate Bill 5702, but I do have a question. When did we as a body begin to package fees all together into one bill?
Mr. Rocco.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the only time we do that is during the short session, because typically in a longer session, each agency has the ability to submit bills to the legislature, so they would submit their own fee ratification bill. During the short session, agencies are not allowed to submit bills directly. So the Legislative Fiscal Office works with them to package them into one bill.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Any comments? Yes, Senator, or Representative Whitsitt.
I'm a no, and it's just because I'm a no on all of the marijuana because it's a federally controlled substance still. I'm just explaining why I'm no on this. I'm doing it on the floor.
Any additional? Any objections to the motion before the committee? Senator Whitsitt?
Get Senator Thompson, too.
Senator Thompson. Representative Whitsitt. Motion carries. Okay, close that work session, open a work session. 5201 allocation, Senator Johnson.
Thank you, colleagues. On February 25th, the Capital Construction Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of House Bill 5201 with amendments. House Bill 5201 adjusts the allocation from the Administrative Services Economic Development Fund lottery funds and from the criminal fine account to distribute these resources as needed to implement the 2016 session budget adjustments. The bill increases lottery allocations by $819,035 and criminal fine account allocations by $1,063,680 to address costs of employee compensation plan changes. Two, establishes a $400,000 lottery allocation to the Oregon Business Development Department for the redevelopment of the Port of Port Orford Cannery Building, and increases lottery allocations to OBDD by $260,514 to expand administrative support for the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program. It increases by $200,000 for the Oregon Wave Energy Trust and by $100,000 for the Willamette Valley Intermodal Hub Feasibility Study. Three, it increases the criminal fines and assessment allocation to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training for a one-time increase in training classes. Four, it increases the lottery allocation to the state school fund in support of a fund shift that does not change the level of state school fund support approved in the 2015 session. The Capital Construction Subcommittee recommends House Bill 5201 be amended by the -4 amendment and be reported out due pass as amended.
Discussion of the motion before the committee.
I just have one thing to say. I'm a yes on it, but I just want to make sure that we understand on the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program that we need to make sure the primary amount of money is being spent on seismic rehabilitation and not on expanded administrative support. I just want that on there.
Any additional discussion? Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, motion passes. We'll close that work session, open a work session, HB 5202, bonding authorization. Senator Gerard.
Well, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On February 25th, the Capital Construction Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of House Bill 5202 as amended. House Bill 5202 amends the limits established during the 2015 legislative session on the maximum amount of bonds and third-party financing agreements that state agencies may issue. The proceeds from the issuance of bonds are included as revenues in agencies' budgets. The subcommittee recommends $5,070,000 in Article 11Q bonds for a project at Portland Community College for the American Manufacturing Innovation District. The subcommittee also recommends increasing the Article 11Q authority of $81.1 million for 10 projects. The projects are described in the budget report. Lottery revenue bonds for other projects totaling $11.3 million. Those projects are also described in the budget report. There will be $2.5 million in general fund debt service in the 2015-17 biennium for new projects. Estimated debt service will total $20.8 million general fund and $2.2 million lottery fund during the 2017-19 biennium. The bill and budget reports contains clarifying language related to refunding bonds for public university and approved scope changes to projects at some community colleges. The Capital Construction Subcommittee recommends House Bill 5202 be amended by the -5 amendments and be reported out due pass as amended.
Any discussion of the motion before the committee? Any objection to the motion before the committee? Seeing none, motion carries.
Did you want to say something?
Yeah, Can you want to get it on the record?
Just very quickly, colleagues, I need to declare a conflict of interest. I'm a member of a limited liability company that does business and economic development in Eastern Oregon, and there actually are some counties in here that may benefit from this package. So,
take us home.
Close that hearing?
I will.
Or work session. Open a work session, 5203 Capitol Construction, Senator Girod.
I will try to take us home here. On February 25th, the Capitol Construction Subcommittee voted to recommend passage of House Bill 5203 with amendments. House Bill 5203 is the budget bill for capital construction projects. The bill establishes authority for the planning, design, and construction of projects with costs over $1 million. Each project must be authorized by the legislature. Some of the projects are funded with bond proceeds provided in House Bill 5202. Project approval and expenditure limitations expire 6 years after being authorized. Project approved in this bill will expire on June 30th, 2021. The bill also changes the amount of some of the projects approved during the 2015 session. The budget report lists a description of capital construction projects and the expenditure limitation amounts. The Capital Construction Subcommittee recommends House Bill 5203 as amended by the Dash 3 amendments and be reported out due pass as amended.
Discussion of the motion before the committee. Yes, Senator Girod.
I would just like to say ponies would be nice with periods and commas.
Mr. Kutcher. Did you want to jump in on that? Senator.
They probably do that. We've been having sort of a very lively discussion through email about ponies tonight. So, we'll take a look at that.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. Out of an abundance of caution, I'm a member of a limited liability company that does business development, economic development in Eastern Oregon, and therefore I'd like to declare a potential conflict of interest. Thank you. Just push rewind.
Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion before the committee? Seeing none, motion carries. Colleagues, before we can completely tonight, Representative Buckley.
Senator Devlin, I just wanted to offer a few brief words of thanks to both the members and the staff for the work in this session and for all the sessions you've worked. It's not clear. I know that many of us see each other, obviously, either in the chamber floors the next several days, but in e-board during the session. But we're very grateful for the work done by each member of this committee, each member of the subcommittees. I want to especially acknowledge if Senator Shields will no longer be a member of the Full Ways and Means in 2017, and he's done outstanding work for this committee, and he's been a persistent, I don't know how to describe it, he's been persistent in his efforts to make public safety reform happen. He's been relentless in that work, and I greatly appreciate it. I want to acknowledge it. Representative Reed will also be heading out to different responsibilities, and his work on this committee has been tremendously respected and greatly appreciated. We also have my colleague who I came in.
Yes, sir.
Who I came in with. And thank you for all your work.
Thank you.
And I think we all recognize, that this is the end of our work. Now, I was hoping that the staff stayed around, but I believe in both chambers they will actually come to your floors at the end of the session, and hopefully we can give them then the type of recognition that they deserve. And obviously, my co-chair and the rest of you will still be around for quite a while. We may have some interim committee meetings, actually, for Full Ways and Means, and obviously many of you are on the e-board also. I would say just one word of caution here, because I'm always just seem to be so devoted to
We might be back. It's true.
The work. We have concluded officially all of our work. If there is an error, and we know we never make an error, and if it's discovered, we would probably actually obviously come back here before the end of the session to make a correction in a bill, and that could happen. But again, I think there may be some other Representative Huffman. Did you want
to? You answered it because we had recessed Cap Construction, and so I was just.
Yeah. Okay. And yes, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. From the House side of the table,
I would like to thank our co-chair, Representative Buckley, for your time, your compassion, your level head, your leadership, and everything you've done to make the process go smoothly and to work on behalf of all the citizens of Oregon.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I want to echo that, Mr. Co-Chair, on behalf of all the members in the Oregon House, including the Republican caucus, how much we've appreciated you and your leadership, your willingness to work with us, to be open, to be forthright, to try and find solutions, and to be one of those type of people that's just approachable. And we greatly appreciate you for all you've done.
Thank you. You're here. Any other closing remarks? Obviously, I think most of the people, including my good friend to my left here, will still be around.
You bet.
So we'll have plenty of opportunities to make some very good statements in the future. But that concludes our work for this evening, and we're done. We're done.